Okay, thank you, David. Well, first thing I'd like to say is that I've really prepared this talk to be a fairly general overview, and I'm a little bit scared seeing all these experts and workshop participants in the audience, but no, I realize there are some non-experts, and what I want to say is that I will keep it as a general talk. Okay. So before I get into the heart of the matter, I would like to start with a few general and to some extent perhaps even somewhat philosophical remarks. Also, this workshop on correlated electrons is already basically at midterm, and I think it's a good time to pause a little bit and emphasize what is the general scope of what we are trying to do, and also to convey, particularly to the general audience, some of the excitement we have and of the things we learned during this workshop already, because we did learn some things, I think. Okay, so as you very well know, strong electron-electron interactions in solid can induce a great diversity of phenomena. For example, they can turn a conventional band insulator, a band metal into an insulator due to correlations. This is the phenomenon of the Mott metal to insulator transition, which will take a rather important part in my talk, and I'll return to that later. They are responsible for also long-range ordered phases, like magnetic phases, antiferromagnetic, for example, and they may be responsible for certain form of unconventional superconductivity. The really fascinating thing is that very often all these phenomena arise in the same compound as you change slightly some parameters, like, for example, temperature or chemical composition or pressure or doping. And so even in a given compound or in a series of very closely related compounds, you see quite a rich diversity of physical phenomena occurring. And I just want to draw, okay, I tend to draw experimental things on the board. I have the data on my laptop for those who are really demanding. Okay, so let me give a few examples of that. One is something which is a sort of icon of the field, which is the phase diagram of this oxide, V2O3. Vanadium is a transition metal, and as a function of temperature and pressure, this compound basically has a phase diagram which looks something like that. At low enough temperature, in the 170 Kelvin range, it orders into an antiferromagnetic insulator. But if you apply enough pressure, this compound, this antiferromagnetic transition can be made to be at a lower and lower temperature, and eventually you get into a paramagnetic metal. And somewhere here, there is a transition line. All these transitions are actually first order, which ends into a second order critical point at a scale of 400 Kelvin, in which the system goes from a paramagnetic insulator, which is to say that as you heat up the system above this Snell transition, the system loses its antiferromagnetic long-range order, but remains insulating. And this paramagnetic insulating phase is separated from this paramagnetic metallic phase by a very sharp first-order transition. And of course, since there is no distinction between a metal and an insulator at finite temperature, it can go round this first-order line through this second-order critical point. I'll return to that in a short while. This is just to illustrate that already on this single compound, you can see all this rich diversity of possible behavior. Another example of a class of systems which also has a very rich behavior is a class of two-dimensional organic compounds.
Antoine, can you put a number on the horizontal axis?
Yes. Well, I was. Okay, now you're asking for numbers.
Just tell a person like me who doesn't know anything.
Right. So this is actually a good question.
How high a pressure?
Right. If you look at pure V2O3 at ambient pressure, pure V2O3 is actually sitting somewhere here. Okay. So you are not going to go through this transition even if you apply pressure on pure V2O3, because you are going to go more metallic instead of going more insulating. If you want to reach that region of the phase diagram, you actually have to chemically substitute V2O3 by ions which will exert some sort of negative pressure.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Well, you don't
and pressure, and then you will have that. So this is either physical pressure. You can press it that way, but if you want to go that way, you have to do some chemical substitution or chemical substitution.
Okay, got
it. Okay, but I haven't answered your question about on that scale, this is about 4 kilobars.
Maybe it's more useful to say what the change in the lattice constant is or something?
Yes, there is a change, so now we are getting into detailed questions, you know. I would like to keep it to keep this simple. There is a change of lattice parameters through that transition, which is a few percent, but not a change of lattice symmetry. Okay, the 2D organics, yes.
Can I ask you a question about the lattice parameter, which is not a detail?
It's not a detail. It's an important issue, I agree.
Well, the particular question, at least if my sense of small is right, it's a puzzling thing. So from your understanding of this material, could you answer the following question? Suppose I have V2O3 and take some reference lattice parameter. And now imagine that you fix the nuclei at this lattice parameter and you change the temperature. Would you be able to pick up this first-order transition or not?
Okay. So obviously, the only thing I can tell you is whether we think that this happens in a model where we would do exactly this, namely fix the lattice parameter and look at a purely electronic model. Okay? And the answer to that question is yes, that does happen in some models. Now, whether in a more concrete compound this will happen, I would leave this open. But in any case, can I come back to this question later on?
Yeah, let me just make one more comment. Because the V2O3, I mean, this goes back, I don't know, 30, 40 years. At this is the whole thing started there.
Yes.
And this is a very exciting thing, this phase boundary that ends in a critical point. But I would have hoped, you know, that in those 30 or 40 years, the community could now give a firmer answer than you gave.
Walter, I think the situation is actually nicer than what you describe. We've only known for, I think, 6 or 7 years that in a purely electronic model, such a first-order finite temperature transition between a paramagnetic insulator and a paramagnetic metal does indeed happen. I don't think any theory convincingly proved that before, say, the developments that happened over the past decade. So there has been progress. I think 20 years ago, the answer to that question was, we don't know. And since these theories have been around, we now know.
No,
at least in models.
You don't know. Well, by the way, I mean, I'll just put my cards on the table. I think we two or three would not have this.
Well, we know in models. Okay, so that was one example, and that was just meant to be one example. Let me show you another one, which does have a similar phase diagram, and that's these 2D organics, which have an even more fascinating phase diagram, pressure, temperature, and now we again have a first-order transition between a paramagnetic insulator and a paramagnetic metal, and an antiferromagnetic phase somewhere here. But this can now coexist with superconductivity developing in this system as we increase pressure. And all these scales are quite different from V2O3. This is about 40 Kelvin. And this is only, and that connects to Tony's remark, this is only 200 bars. So this transition can be nicely studied using gas pressure. Okay. And very little is known, actually, to elaborate on Walter's comment about the change in lattice constant through that transition. But as far as I know, it's undetectably small. So maybe that's a partial answer to your question, just from nature. OK, so I was going to also draw on this board the phase diagram for high TC cube rates, just to illustrate the diversity of phenomena we can see. But everybody has probably this phase diagram more or less in mind, so I'm not going to do that. What? Yes? This is a first order line. This is a second order line. The antiferromagnetic phase, as far as I know here, is second order, but I think it is.
In what sense are these materials in the same class? I mean,
well, can I?
They look quite different.
They are quite different. They are in the same class in the sense that they all have, they share many features, actually. They all have rather localized orbitals, namely electrons that have relatively small bandwidth as compared to the strength of Coulomb interaction. They all have somewhat frustrated magnetism. This has frustrated magnetism because these 2D layers are actually triangular layers, and isotropic triangular layers. This has frustrated magnetism for two reasons. One has to do, which are actually tied together, one has to do with competing ferro and antiferro exchanges, and the other one has to do with orbital degeneracy in the paramagnetic phases. Yes?
You mentioned several times critical point of second order was there. Critical
yes.
point is critical point constant the order.
This guy.
Yeah, so what is
the is a critical endpoint.
It's just a critical point, isn't it?
This is first order. Right? This is like a liquid gas transition.
It's just a critical point. There's nothing special about your word second order critical point.
No. No, critical point. I'm just contrasting first order and second order transition, that's all. Okay. So this was just meant to illustrate the diversity of phenomena we can see in such systems. And what I would like now to explain a little bit more is, what about the title of this talk? Why was I talking about top-to-bottom approaches? Okay, faced with a situation in which we have such a diversity of behavior, and faced also with the difficulties that theorists have encountered in treating strong electronic correlation effects, there's been basically two lines of approaches that have been used by theorists, and that pretty much provide some line of division in the community, even though some people are playing in both camps, like myself sometime. One can think of taking a sort of bottom-to-top approaches in which one focuses one's attention on a given physical phenomenon, a given phase of these complicated materials, and try to go directly at the low energy physics. Try to guess directly what is the relevant low energy fixed point and what is the low energy effective theory. This is the most important part, which controls the low energy excitations on top of that fixed point. This, of course, has been a very, very valuable approach in condensed matter physics for many phenomena. And the problem with this approach is that often it's very difficult then first to go back to microscopic foundations of such a guess for the low energy fixed point. And second, it's not always very easy to relate the phase you've been focusing your attention on to the neighboring phases, for example, to assess stability, relative stability of the various possible phases. Now, there is another approach that one can take, which is the sort of top-to-bottom approach, which, in a sense, is technically very challenging. And this kind of approach starts from a microscopic Hamiltonian. So how microscopic you want to be depends, of course, on how courageous you are. You may want to start all the way from atomic energy scale. After all, we all know what is the Hamiltonian of a solid. We all know it is something like this. Kinetic energy of electrons, ionic potential seen by the electrons, plus some Coulomb interaction. So a very, very challenging task would be to start from this admittedly very microscopic Hamiltonian and go down in energy scale from tens and tens of electron volt down to the relevant energy scales in the problem, which, as you see from here, are a few hundreds or a few tens of Kelvin. Of course, these top-to-bottom approaches are very ambitious. Sometimes one downscale a bit one's ambition and start from a simpler, quote-unquote, simpler effective Hamiltonian, which is not supposed to be valid all the way up to 100 electron volts, but which is supposed to be valid in a few electron volt energy shell, focusing the attention on those orbitals that are really important for the problem. And that would be, for example, starting from a Hubbard-like Hamiltonian, which would basically consider one or a few orbitals on in a tight binding description and have these electrons hopping around with a strong on-site repulsion. This is the simplest model, which is still somewhat microscopic, but in the sense that it's not a real low-energy effective theory, but, of course, is a lot simplified as compared to this. Okay, so this, if you want to use a sort of picturesque RG language, the bottom-to-top approaches tries to guess the fixed point and build the low-energy effective theory, assess what is the low-energy effective theory attached to that fixed point. And then, of course, in order to relate to microscopic, one would like to integrate backwards the flow a little bit to see what model can give you that fixed point. The top-to-bottom approaches try to do something which is a priori quite difficult, which is to start from really low energy and then follow the RG flow as much as you can in order to come to grasp with low energy and follow the flow to as low an energy as you can. Of course, hopefully, these two kind of approaches can meet somewhere in the middle and can hopefully get at some consistent view of the problem. Admittedly, we are not really yet there in the field of correlated electrons, but a few of the examples I'd like to give you in the rest of this talk may suggest that we are getting close and that at some point in a few years, we'll be able to really match these two kind of approaches. Okay, obviously the line of attack that this workshop has been focusing in, the workshop we're currently having here, is focusing in, belongs to the top to bottom kind of philosophy, either starting from very, very high energy microscopic things like this, or trying to come to grasp with low energy effective models. And I would like to say a few words as to why we believe that this sort of approach is important for strongly correlated electron systems. Okay, there are several reasons. The first reason, I think, is that it so happens in correlated electron systems that the energy scales below which you have to go to really reach the low energy regime can be very, very small. And you already see this in these phase diagrams. Here you see that the interesting action takes place around a few hundred Kelvin. This is a factor of 40 or 50 smaller than 1 electron volt. So this is definitely a very, very strong reduction of the important energy scales in the problem as compared to what happens in weakly correlated systems. Okay, so this is saying two things. First of all, that these top to bottom approaches have to be pretty clever. They cannot be just simple high temperature series, for example, that proved to be very successful in the early investigations of critical phenomena, because you would have to continue this path coming from high energy down to really small scales. But this is also saying that the bottom to top approaches are going to face a very severe difficulty, which is that the low energy scale below which they are valid can be pretty small. And actually, I will argue later that even in that region of the phase diagram, you haven't really reached a low energy effective theory for that metal that would be in that compound, Landau Fermi liquid theory, but that the energy scale below which you would have to go in order to see the physics of a Landau Fermi liquid in its simplest formulation is really somewhere there. And here you have something else that, if you want to understand, you really have to know something about not only the low energy fixed point, but also how you flow into it coming from high energies. So there is this notion of coherent scale that I want to emphasize.
Can I make just a passing remark here?
Sure.
It's not that very widely known that the Landau theory is also not a low energy theory.
Well, in what sense?
In what sense? That it is not the lowest energy.
We all know that. I think we know about Kornit and Giravolta, if this is what you mean.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
I know that's what you mean.
I simply mention it because this is a very typical situation that, Landau theory, of course, all of us use, and properly so, as a low energy theory, but in fact, it is not really a low energy.
It can be made. It can be made a low energy theory.
I'm trying to make a different point here. That the situation you described is a rather characteristic situation.
Well, thank you. I mean, I think you are trying to help. my point is that it's perhaps a characteristic situation, but it's certainly needed, badly needed, for correlated systems more than I think for. Well, okay, we could argue about that. It's certainly needed for correlated systems. Okay, so coherent scales, yeah. So what I was saying is that effective coherent scales that I'll describe a little bit more precisely later can be a lot smaller than characteristic electronic energies. Okay. Another aspect which, in my view, make these top-to-bottom approaches desirable is that in order to assess the relative stability of these various phases, one has to compute total energies and free energies if we are at finite temperatures. And it is not clear that to do that, you cannot be happy with relatively short landscale physics. It is not clear that the really long wavelength effective theories are essential to assess things like energy differences. And in fact, this is a particularly pressing issue in strongly correlated systems, because we know that all these materials have phases which are in very tight competition. We know that if we change something in the cube rates, you can go from a charge ordered state to a state which has antiferromagnetic, which is an antiferromagnetic metal. And we know that we can easily kill superconductivity by changing a little bit something in the material. So we need to focus on things that you may want to call material specifics or irrelevant details, but in fact, because you have many, many phases which are in close competition, you have to tackle with. Okay, finally, one of the reasons why these top-to-bottom approaches are, in my view, important is because it's not entirely clear that in many regions of these phase diagrams, you have, it's quite clear that in many regions of these phase diagrams, you have correlation length, which are not necessarily very big, at least for the obvious orders that you have in the system. You may have hidden orders that have longer correlation length. This is a work for the bottom to top approach. But given the orders that are apparent in the systems, there are significant regions in the phase diagrams where the correlation length are relatively small, and where an approach coming from short distances might be okay. Okay, so this is what I want now to, how I want to organize the rest of this talk. What I want to tell you about is some of the successes and some of the limitations also of an approach that has been developed over the last decade, and which is one of the themes of the current workshop, which is dynamical mean field theory, which is definitely the sort of top-to-bottom approach. I will review some of the successes of that problem, focusing on the mod transition. Then I would like to present a few of the things that we've learned here. During these past 2.5 months, and that connect to this specific issue. There are many things also that we learned and that I'm not going to talk about, obviously. And finally, I would like to say how some of these things connect to life in lower dimensions, and perhaps even to some of the bottom-to-top descriptions. And if I have time towards the end, I would like to give a few ideas on how, for a real solid, to ground this sort of approach, to put this sort of approach on more rigorous ground. I don't know if I'll have time to go to this, but this is goes under the category of functionals and is basically geared at Walter. Let's see if we can get there. Okay, so first of all, let me, of course, I'm building a little bit on the Blackboard talk that Gabby Kotler gave 3 weeks ago, but since I assume that some of you were not around, I will very briefly review some of the things that were said during that Blackboard talk. Okay, so first of all, why are strongly correlated solids difficult to treat theoretically? Well, if we're in a weakly correlated solid, we pretty much have a distinction between two kinds of electrons. There are electrons that are very high in energy and sit calmly on their atom. And my electronic structure friend might want to call them core electrons. And there are electrons that tend to delocalize over the whole system, form an electron gas, and be describable in terms of Kohn-Chaumont growth. And there is a nice distinction between these two. Some are wave-forming electrons, and the other ones are localized electrons. In strongly correlated systems, there are nasty players. And these nasty players are the electrons which are somewhat schizophrenic. They don't know whether they want to be tight to the atom or whether they want to delocalize over the whole solid. There is a very simple reason, which is basically an atomic-like reason, why this happens. This happens because in, for example, transition metals, the D shells, even though they are outer shells, do not have any strong reason to be extended. The wave functions of these D shells are pretty much localized, and that's basically because they don't have to be orthogonal to any of the other shells, because there are no other shells with the same angular momentum. So their wave function can stay pretty much localized on the atom. Same argument applies, for example, to the 4F electrons in the rare earth series. And these electrons, to some extent, are atomic-like. If we look at them on relatively high energy scales, they are localized. But if we look at them on low energy, long distance scales, then they may want to do something like band forming. So the theorist is confronted with a problem where he has two things about waves in K-space to describe the low energy, and he also has two things about real space in the atomic language to describe the high energy. And there is no way you can do one or the other. You have to do both at the same time. Okay, so that's, I think, the core of the difficulty. And we have to think both in K-space and in real space. And that's exactly what this dynamical mean field theory approach does. So let me summarize it here in a nutshell. And I'll do that just on this simple Hubbard model to keep our life simple. So what is DMFT doing? DMFT is, first of all, let me illustrate these two atomic and band-like point of view. Look at this model when T is zero. Okay? When T is zero, we basically have just a collection of quote-unquote atoms. These atoms are really caricatural objects in the Hubbard model, which in which we have four levels, which can be occupied, unoccupied, occupied by one electron, or doubly occupied. Okay, and this will cost energy zero. This will cost energy epsilon zero, if I add here some reference energy level, and this will cost two epsilon zero plus U. And at T equal to zero, we have an immensely degenerate situation, especially if we are in the situation where we have one electron per site. We have two to the n spin degeneracy. And if we look at one electron excitations, on that mixture of up and down sides, say we are at half filling, then we are going to see that the spectral function A of omega for adding or removing an electron will have two peaks at minus U over 2 and plus U over 2. And that corresponds to the transition in which I empty the ground state and the transition where I create a double occupancy. When U is zero, we just have a band in a tight binding description. So we have Bloch waves. And these are the energies. Say we're on a cubic lattice, something like this. So this density of states, our excitations are really one electron excitations. And this A of omega will just be the density of states of that problem, that band. I'm just drawing a caricature here with a certain bandwidth. And the problem is how we go as we turn on U over T from that situation to that situation. What happens? OK, so the DMFT description of this problem is the following. It really – let us think that we have a little Maxwell daemon in the system, which sits on one side. And this Maxwell daemon is very, very myopic. It can only look at its given side. Okay? So it can only see whether there is one electron, zero electron, or a doubly occupied site. And what this Maxwell daemon does is that it writes an effective action for the quantum transitions between these two things, between these value states. That's what it does. So our little daemon will know only about one thing, which is the one electron Green's function at a given site, completely local in space, as a function of frequency. And what it will do, it will choose to represent, and I insist on this word, GII of omega, in terms of what we call an impurity problem. This is a quantum many-body problem which has no spatial degrees of freedom, and which basically has an effective action containing only two terms. Let me call this S impurity. One term, which is the original Coulomb repulsion, and one other term, which describes the possibility of an electron to leave the site at a given time tau, come back at another time tau prime with a certain amplitude here that we like to call g naught minus 1. So that's what the Maxwell daemon writes. It's an action for our local processes. And the statement is that, and that's a slightly different catch than some other presentations of DMFT, the statement is that if you were to give me the exact local Green's function of this Hubbard model, say in two dimensions or three dimensions, then I would be able to find for you a G0, which is such that by solving this problem, I will get that G. So it's really a question of representability. This is my choice for representing the local Green's function of that impurity problem. Of course, at this stage, it is a completely empty statement because I haven't told you how I'm going to calculate G. I just have told you that if you give me G, I can find a G0. So that's number one. And I believe this can be turned into an exact representability statement in the same spirit that within density functional theory, we can represent the local density in a solid in terms of the solution of a non-interacting one-particle Schrödinger equation. Now, of course, we need to do more in the same sense that in DFT, we need to construct the density functional. And that's the second step, in which, if you want, our little daemon makes a further assumption, and that's really DMFT. The further assumption is that the self-energy that you are going to get from solving this problem, which will be a frequency-dependent quantity only, which will be the difference between this effective bare propagator and G, that this self-energy can be extended to the whole lattice. So this is a very strong statement, which of course is generally not true, because in real life, this self-energy for the whole lattice will be a k-dependent object. Here we assume it's not a k-dependent object, it's a purely frequency-dependent object. But then we get a set of closed equations, which is the following. Our Green's function, let me focus on phases which have absolutely no kind of symmetry breaking, just for simplicity. The Green's function is going to be something like this. This is usually a function of k and omega. I'm going to assume this disappears, and I'm going to assume that I can use this sigma into that equation. And for consistency, of course, I should have that g of omega the thing I can compute within the local problem is equal to the local lattice Green's function. So you see that solving this for a given G0 is one problem, which gives one relation between G0 and G, while ensuring that G0 and G are related by this equation, sigma being just G0 minus 1 minus G minus 1, is another relation, and that in principle these two things give you a set of equations which is enough to fully determine both this, this, and that.
What is the small parameter that allows you to cross off the k-dependence?
Okay, that's an excellent question. That was my next point. This small parameter was discovered actually before this framework really emerged by Walter Metzner and Dieter Wohlhardt. Dieter was here at the beginning, and Walter is now sitting in the room. And this small parameter is dimensionality, or rather, connectivity of the lattice. If you send these parameters to infinity, then not surprisingly, you will discover that this is exact.
Properly scaling U or something.
Properly scaling not U, because U is local, but the hopping T. You have to scale the hopping as T star over square root of the connectivity, the same way you have to scale the exchange coupling by 1 over the connectivity when you do usual mean field theory. The reason why this is true, you can immediately guess. This description keeps all local quantum fluctuations, but freezes spatial fluctuations. And if you have many, many neighbor, it's the well-known thing of mean field theory that spatial fluctuations get small. So we have an approximation. And again, I want to stress that this is an approximation only insofar as we do this. That would be, I believe, only a statement about representability of the local Green's function. We have an approximation which is controlled by some parameter, so it makes some of us theorists happy, because at least we know that we are probably not going to get completely absurd results mathematically. We may get completely absurd results physically, but mathematically we are going to get a consistent theory. Okay, so let me now, so are there any questions about the general formalism, these two equations? No. Okay, so let me say what has been done with this on the problem of the mod transition that was already alluded to before. This approach has provided a fairly complete theory of the mod transition in such a simple model as the Hubbard model. Many of these, the aspects of this theory are not entirely new, but this is, I believe, the first theory that puts these various bits and pieces together into a single framework in which you can compare the stability of various phases, and you also discover some new aspects. So this is the phase diagram of what you will get for a Hubbard model at half filling, just to keep things simple here. As you solve these DMFT equations, what you find is that there is a low temperature regime here in which things heavily depend on the details of the model. By that, I mean that if you have very unfrustrated magnetic order, just taking, for example, a bipartite lattice with nearest neighbor Tij, then this will actually be a huge antiferromagnetic insulating phase.
You mean a three-dimensional system here?
Yeah, whatever, three-dimensional. Do DMFT on the three-dimensional cubic lattice, for example. Okay. If you don't frustrate the magnetism at all, if you just have nearest neighbor hopping on a cubic lattice, you will get a huge nil temperature like this. Well, by huge, I mean that this can easily be, say, 1/10 of the bandwidth, something like that. And this, of course, will be like 1 over U, like the super exchange coupling. This will be very small, like spin density wave mean field theory. However, if you change a little bit the model, if you frustrate magnetism by putting a second neighbor hopping, you can actually frustrate magnetism a lot, and generically you will get into a situation where here you have some antiferromagnetic insulating phase, and probably here some pocket of antiferromagnetic metallic phase. Now, as magnetism is frustrated, what happens is that the genuine mod physics is revealed. And it's revealed in the sense that what happens is a first order transition between a paramagnetic metallic phase at weak coupling and a paramagnetic insulating phase at strong coupling, which are separated by a first order transition, ending into a critical point. So I think that this provides one firm answer to the question as to whether one can ever stabilize such a liquid gas-like mod transition in the original sense of the mod transition in a purely electronic model. This is from the MFT, and one of the things that we've learned from in this workshop when Masa Imara from Tokyo came here is that this probably also exists in two-dimensional situations in which the magnetism is frustrated enough. I'll come back to that in a minute, but let me stick with this for a while. Finding such a phase diagram within the MFT means that, in fact, here, if you try to solve these mean field equations, you will have some coexistence regime here, in which you will find coexisting insulating and metallic solutions of your equations, with this line being determined from free energy considerations. By the way, note the curvature of this line. It is such that you, if you heat up the system, you go from a paramagnetic metal to a paramagnetic insulator. And the reason for that is basically the Pomeranchuk effect for helium-3. It's basically the fact that if you have a metal, it has linear entropy, but if you have a paramagnetic insulator, it has log 2 entropy per site because of the spin degeneracy. So as you heat up the system starting from a metal, you can gain a lot of entropy by localizing your spins. This is why you can solidify helium-3 at high pressures by heating the system, and this is exactly the same here. This is also, I believe, why in V2O3 the phase transition line has the curvature as in the experiments I showed before. Okay. Second remark I want to make is this energy scale here that I haven't told you about. This energy scale here is very small. It's about 1 over 80. This is what we learned by solving this DMFT equation. So you see that indeed, these sort of top-to-bottom approaches that start from a microscopic model cannot be very unsophisticated approaches. Imagine you were doing high-temperature series in beta times the hopping. Then you would have to reach values of the expansion parameter, which is such that beta t is of order 80 to get into the interesting regime. The MFT is not quite doing something as naive. It is doing something which is local, so it's focusing on local physics, but it's keeping all energy scales in that local physics. So it's only half of a mean field theory. It's a mean field theory for spatial degrees of freedom, but it's not a mean field theory for energy or for time. Okay, so low energy scales, as I emphasized before. The low temperature physics depends on many of the microscopic details of the model. This behavior here, on the other hand, is rather universal and independent of the microscopic details. In particular, there is now, based on this DMFT, a rather detailed understanding of this critical point, which we believe that's worked by Gabby Kotler and co-workers, Marshall Rosenberg, who is sitting here too. We believe that this is an Ising critical point, not surprisingly, which shares many features with a liquid gas transition. We've also seen that frustration is essential to show mod physics so that mod physics becomes apparent, mod physics in its pure form. If we didn't have frustration, this phase would move up there. And yes.
This is Ising in the trivial sense, where you're at d equals infinity?
This is, well, of course, I mean, this is mean field. It's in d equal infinity, this is Ising with mean field exponents, okay? Yes.
If you suppress the magnetism all the way to zero temperature,
yes,
is the paramagnetic insulating state that your theory describes just free moments?
Yes. Okay. So, absolutely. So, if we frustrate the system to the extent that this is gone, which one can do in very large dimensions, which actually one can also do in finite dimensions by looking at very frustrated lattices, as we now know, then within that description, we'll get this coexistence region and all this thing, but the paramagnetic insulator here is just a bunch of free moments, in a sense that if you compute the, well, it is a bunch of free moments in a sense, namely the entropy will be n log 2, for example. Okay, so obviously this description of the paramagnetic insulator from such a mean field picture cannot reliably be extended down to arbitrarily low temperature if you are interested in a finite dimensional system. Spin correlations will come in. Note that, however, spin correlation, even in this theory, are apparent in the sense that if you compute the uniform susceptibility, Q equals zero susceptibility, of that phase, you will find that it is not infinite at zero temperature, but it is of order 1 over j, all right. So I let you appreciate that slight paradox, that this is a phase which, within that mean field description, has a local susceptibility, which is Curie, but which has a uniform susceptibility, which is 1 over j. And we can discuss that in more detail. This is due to the fact that exchange physics, the physics of nearest neighbor exchange, couples to two particle quantities in that limit of large dimensions or DMFT, but does not couple to one particle properties. So for example, the scale J does not play a role in the one particle Green's function. This is a limitation of the approach. One has to go beyond that, for example, using bigger clusters. Okay, so what we can do from that approach, beyond phase diagram.
Results like this are obtained numerically.
No. All these results, I mean, most of these results here, okay, are a conspiracy between, I would say, three things. One are sort of brute force numerical approaches. One is analytical approaches which focus on a particular region, okay? For example, we know that close to this critical point here, we have a separation of energy scales in this DMFT equation, and this can be put to good use, eliminating high energy and setting up a sort of RG. This RG still needs a little bit of numerics, but it's a different kind of numerics, okay? And then there are sort of semi-numerical things that use analytical approximation to solve this impurity problem, but that you still have to implement on the computer. So I'm just summarizing on the board the results of several years of investigation, which use a whole range of techniques, from analytical things to numerical things. But basically, I think everything I'm saying here is now established on analytical ground. Okay, so we know not only phase diagrams, we also know things about lots of things about excitations, and I want to make two points about spectroscopy. So previously I said that one of the problems is how we go from our atomic-like spectral function to our band-like spectral function, or density of states. And the MFT has quantitative answers to this question. The quantitative answer it provides is the following. If you take the paramagnetic metal at low temperature and increase the coupling, so starting from that, what you will see is that you narrow a little bit this quasi-particle, this density of states. You narrow it by a quantity which is the quasi-particle residue, quasi-particle weight in lambda of Fermi-Liquid language, and then we put some spectral weight into precursor features of the Hubbard bands. As we go, so that would be U over W smaller than one. As we go to higher couplings, what we see is that this guy here becomes more and more narrow. Z becomes very small. It vanishes continuously at this point in a linear manner with coupling. And the spectral weight is transferred to the Hubbard bands. This three-peak structure, which was predicted now about 10 years ago within these dynamical mean field theory approaches, has become a sort of icon of the field because it was not very clear, I think, before this sort of calculations, that a correlated metal would have both low-energy quasi-particles and preformed Hubbard bands.
How else could you go continuously?
You go continuously from there to there.
I'm just saying, you always have to have three peaks.
No, why? You could get transfer of spectral weight to very large energy, and it's not even clear that you need really to have band narrowing.
You could open
actually,
the gap, I guess.
And then the gap could open, you know. It's not so clear.
Is the weight on the central peak proportional to Z?
Yes, the weight, this is basically fixed, and this weight is proportional to Z. This weight goes continuously to zero. This is K-integrated spectra. Okay, I'm not talking about the delta function quasi-particle peak. I could plot that too, but this is not what I'm plotting here. Okay.
So, these two states is not renormalized or renormalized very moderately?
No. Within one-band models, within this one-band Hubbard, in the MFT, it's not renormalized, okay? And this is obviously something which is an extreme feature of large dimensions. As we go to finite dimensions, I don't know if I have time to say something about that, but this will be changed. Okay, I want to emphasize there is a separation of energy scale here between this Brinkman-Rice scale here and this sort of preformed gap scale, if you want, in the insulator, in the metal. And as we go through the transition, the quasi-particle peak just disappears, and we are left with Hubbard bands separated by a gap. Within this theory, the gap is already finite when Z goes to zero. So there are many features that are not unfamiliar. This narrowing of the central peak is Brinkman-Rice. And this closing of the gap at this critical point here, UC1, is Hubbard physics. But this all happens in a single mathematical framework, and one can describe the transfer of spectral weight between these features as you vary the coupling constant. Actually, you can vary also temperature, not only the coupling constant, starting, for example, from that situation, and you will see that this notion of coherent scale that I was describing before is playing a key role in this story. This coherent scale here, at least at the one particle level, is just Z times W, and it's becoming zero at the critical point. So what happens, the low energy effective theory for such a correlated metal is a Landau Fermi liquid in this picture, in this limit. But of course, it lives only there. Its limit of validity is precisely that scale. As we heat up the system above that scale, what happens is that this coherence peak, this quasi-particle peak, gets smaller and smaller. I could show you plots on the computer if you asked. And the corresponding spectral weight is transferred to basically all energy scales comparable to the Hubbard bands. So I want to emphasize that the range of energy over which the spectral weight is transferred has nothing to do with KT. It is something which is order the mod gap, namely U. OK. So is this seen in experiments? And again, in the same way as to assess these questions of transfer of spectral weight and to establish such a phase diagram in a purely electronic model, one has had to wait many, many years. Well, to see these features in one particle, in experiments able to sample the one particle physics, we also had to wait many, many years. And it's actually only now that we are seeing reliable one electron spectroscopic measurements of correlated metals close to the mod transition. And we've heard at this workshop two very, very nice talks. One by Jim Allen on V2O3, and one reporting on experiments by Suga et al. In Japan. This was mentioned in Dieter Bonnard's talk on strontium VO3. This is a very correlated metal if you are close enough to the mod transition. This actually is a rather weakly correlated metal. But for many, many years, photoemission experiments on this compound were saying that the photoemission signal, which now is more or less this spectral function multiplied by some Fermi function, so that you only see the negative omega part and convoluted with some Gaussian experimental resolution, this spectral function for many, many years was showing something like this. So it was showing something which has very tiny spectral weight at low energy, quite inconsistent with other kind of measurements on this metal, suggesting that this was not such a correlated metal, and also quite inconsistent with such scenarios.
And if you would draw the band structure density of state as a simple, how would it go?
The band structure density of state would go like this. Pretty bad. This has been on for many years, has been around for many years. And what we've seen now is that people are able to make these experiments at a much higher photon energy, going from 20 eV, 40 eV for these purple experiments to several hundreds of eV by going to the synchrotron. And there is a very nice beamline which is managed by this guy in Japan. And the problem is not so much to go to the synchrotron, the problem is to go to the synchrotron and to keep good resolution. So of course, the resolution becomes somewhat worse when you increase photon energy, but the recent progress is allowed to keep this in a reasonable range. And what we've seen, what one has witnessed in very recently, is that as you go to higher and higher photon energy, and actually, to be fair, I should say that this goes back to the work of Didi Sharma and his student Maiti in India about 3-4 years ago, and Marshall has also worked on that. We've seen that as the photon energy is increased, this peak starts showing up. And this is basically saying that photoemission studies are surface sensitive at low photon energies. And as you increase photon energy, you are more and more sensitive to the bulk in such a way, and that for the bulk, actually, this picture seems to be more and more in agreement with experiments, it's now all the way to saying that for the bulk, the photoemission signal is something like this.
Can I ask a question? When you increase the photon energy,
yes,
the photoemission is not, strictly speaking, a single
variable. Unfortunately.
But does it get better in that sense when you increase the frequency?
It might be. Actually,
I think that may be, in fact, a major phenomenon. You attribute this to surface,
Well, I have reasons to attribute this to surface, yeah, because I know other compounds in which the photon energy sensitivity dependence is a lot weaker, like cuprates, fortunately. Mm-hmm. And if your explanation was the dominant one, I think it would also hold for cuprates. But you may be right. I mean, the sudden approximation that, yeah, in technical language is used to analyze photoemission experiments might be better and better at high photon energy.
I think that's probably the case.
So this is good.
And you compare that again to this one electron part. It looks like you recover the whole one electron spectral wave plus something else.
Yes. So now let me compare. Okay, so it just probably doesn't make sense not to show the real data here, okay, because it's hard to draw experimental spectra on the board. So let me show what I really mean. Yes. So what I really mean is this. This is the photoemission spectrum of strontium VO3. And this is what has happened over the years. 21 eV, 40 eV, 275 eV, 900 eV. So you see this peak showing up. And here you see a comparison between the measured intensity and an LDA calculation. So you see this is a moderately correlated metal. The LDA doesn't do so bad. In particular, the value of the density of states close to the Fermi energy is pretty much the LDA one, which is in good agreement with this, this purely local description of correlations. However, there is spectral wave transfer to the lower Hubbard band here, no question about that. Transfer is what?
It's created, not transferred.
No, it's transferred. This is LDA. All this spectral weight is missing and transferred there. Right. And actually, there's been already DMFT calculations for that materials, both in Augsburg's group and by Zilke Biermann, who is sitting here. And these calculated spectra are in very good agreement
with the
experiment. Paramagnetic. This is a paramagnetic metal. It's not a very correlated metal.
When people do LDA calculations, do they get it paramagnetic or ferromagnetic?
I think they get it paramagnetic. Is that correct? I hope they looked for the magnetic solution. Yeah, again, this is not one of these systems in which you would immediately think of doing LDA plus something, okay? I mean, this is not a very correlated system. This is not V2O3, this is not nickel oxide.
All right. No, but what comes to mind, for instance, this recent story is SR3RU2O7, this quantum critical thing, where you also don't want to do LDA plus, you say it's weakly correlated.
Yes.
But LDA is very wrong in the opposite direction. It makes things really magnetic.
Okay. Okay, the short answer to your question is I don't know. I'm not sure this has been carefully checked. Okay, same story about V2O3. We've learned here from Jim Allen, and this is unpublished data that we've seen a few weeks ago at this workshop. We've learned that as you increase photon energy, this peak starts showing up. And I think this is a very nice case for the relevance of such theories for the transfer spectral weight. Okay, so obviously, there are many, many more things that I was planning to tell you, and I'm running badly out of time. I just want to close on at least outlining what I was going to say in the rest of the talk. one of the things I've emphasized is that this sort of mod physics between a paramagnetic insulator and a paramagnetic metal gets particularly apparent when we can frustrate enough magnetism. And this is probably also where these sort of approaches make sense, because we then have small correlation lengths. What about having this physics in low dimensions, in real systems? We've learned something at this workshop from Imada, who investigated with some new numerical techniques the Hubbard model on the square lattice. So this is low-dimensional physics with a T and a T prime, organized in that way, so that if you have T prime equal to T, this is a triangular lattice. The reason he's looking at this problem is because this is a relevant model for the two-dimensional organics I was describing before, I was showing briefly before. And what he finds is that as a function of T prime over T, frustration, and coupling, the phase diagram of that model has a window of paramagnetic insulating phase. Here we have a metal. And here we have an antiferromagnetic insulator. At zero temperature.
What theory is this, DMFT or
not? No. This is, no. Now I'm talking about two dimensions. This theory? Is, it's not theory. It's, well, it is theory, but it is numerical studies. Okay, so the details of the various techniques he's used to investigate that are available live on the web, as you know.
Should we trust them?
I think one should trust them, yes. He's looked in that phase for many kinds of long-range ordering of the hidden kind, and like flux phase, for example, and could not detect any. So this seems to be saying that on such frustrated correlated electron models in low dimension, you can stabilize spin-liquid phases. And by spin liquid, of course, we just mean a correlated paramagnet. That's what we mean. Obviously, this correlated paramagnet cannot be described simply by a bunch of local moments. I'm not saying this. I'm just saying that if we accept the idea that the correlation length in such a state is not too large, correlation will only have a reasonably short range, then extensions of the sort of approach that I've described today could be reasonable starting points. And maybe even there could be a way to match some of the conclusions that are reached by taking this local point of view to other angles of view on these low-dimensional phases, like basically resonating valence bond descriptions. Actually, there is work that goes in that direction that proposes to describe the spin-liquid phase in some range of energy on the Kagome lattice using a plaquette extension, a cluster extension of dynamical mean field ideas. And this is a work I did with Raoul Siddharthan and Serge Florence about a year ago. Okay, so I think Imada, in his talk, even went further. He went all the way to say that this model has a first-order finite temperature phase transition using other kind of techniques from a metal to an insulator of a similar kind than the one I was describing in the MFT. So this is, I would pose as an open question. Finite T transition. In this system. So on focusing on this sort of problems, I think this is a place where the sort of top to bottom and bottom to top approaches can have a fruitful exchange and try to reach a consistent view of this sort of phenomena. Another regime in which I think we can have a constructive exchange with theorists, in particular theorists who like to split electrons in different pieces, are these strongly incoherent metals. So I have introduced the notion of a coherent scale, epsilon F star. And I've shown you that we have a quantitative, we have some quantitative tools to understand, well, at least to compute what's going on in a metal in that regime. I've shown you this strong transfer of spectral weight as a function of temperature. This has correspondingly an effect on the resistivity, which is that in the resistivity of such a metal is T square up to about epsilon F star. But then as the quasi-particle resonance disappears when you increase temperature, it's becoming very large, larger than the Mott limit, and still metallic-like in a roughly linear fashion. And then as you reach a scale which is still smaller than this preformed gap, you can get insulating-like behavior. This regime is a regime which is very, very hard to describe if you focus only on low energy theories. But it's a regime in which splitting the electron into a spin-carrying fermions and a boson and treating both of these dynamically might be a good starting point. Admittedly, we have tools to calculate here, but we don't have many tools to understand. And this is a regime in which I think one can start some discussion with this sort of approaches. Okay, so there were other things I was planning to cover on these issues of connecting to lower dimensionality systems and more low energy approaches. I'm not going to do that. Let me just summarize in one or two sentences what I was planning to say on this topic and that I will not have time to cover. Okay, what I was planning to say on this topic was that, yes.
Yes. What scale is this, insulating phase found in U and T prime?
Okay, this is it. Yes. This is Imara's phase diagram that he showed here. Oops. Optics. Here you should not, I mean, he doesn't want to commit himself. That's what has been studied.
And in the recoupling, he doesn't observe superconductivity, which should be there. Based on the
Kuhn-Luttinger
argument.
Yes. Okay, please look at his, listen to his talk, okay? The studies have been conducted here. Okay, this, I think, is just indicative. Okay, so just to conclude, let me just outline what I wanted to say about these functionals. This probably will be the subject of other talks at the workshop. What I wanted to say has, as a starting point, this remark that I made, that you can view the MFT as two things, and the first building block is just an issue of representability. It's the notion that if you are handed the exact local Green's function of the model, then you are going to be able to find a unique hybridization function in your Anderson impurity language. So I call it G0 of omega. You can call it also delta of omega, which is such that by solving this local problem, you will reconstruct the exact G of omega. I believe actually one can extend that concept to a real solid, not only the Hubbard model, provided that one works as with a functional, well, not only with one object, which is the local Green's function, but with two objects, namely the local Green's function and the local components of the screened effective interaction that can be precisely defined from the density-density correlation function and the bare Coulomb interaction. So the idea is that if you, in a certain basis, are being handed these two quantities for a real solid, you will be able to find an extended form of a single impurity model which will have this as a solution. Naturally, of course, in that case, you are not only asking for the one-particle hybridization in the effective action, you are also asking for an effective frequency-dependent interaction in your impurity model. Something which generalizes the concept of a Hubbard U to a frequency-dependent object. So this is one line of research that is being conducted these days, and by several people here, Gabi Kotlia and co-workers, myself, Sasha Lichtenstein, Silke Biermann, is to make this work. But I really think that one can disentangle the problem into a question of representation, namely representing suitably chosen local objects in terms of an effective impurity problem, and another issue, which is the precise construction of the functional, for which, of course, we have ideas which come from DMFT or from extensions of DMFT, trying to combine that with GW approaches or RPA.
From a technical point of view, you want to make frequency-dependent CPD, right? That's what you
want. No. I want to even have frequency-dependent interactions in the local problem.
Right. So it's what we, from point of view, I mean, right now there are calls which do CPA, which is a self-consistent
process
and everything, but starting.
Yes. Okay, CPA, I suppose what you have in mind is the idea of decoupling the interaction with an auxiliary boson field, right? And really considering a local approximation for the correlation function of this boson field, but which will be time dependent, right? If this is what you have in mind, this indeed is related to that. Okay, I think I'll stop here.